The reading is from Mark chapter 14. If you're using one of the church Bibles, it's page 718. And that's Mark chapter 14. Now the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were looking for some sly way to arrest Jesus and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or the people may riot. While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of a man known as Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, "Why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor." And they rebuked her harshly. "Leave her alone," said Jesus. "Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them any time you want, but we will not always have me. She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. I tell you the truth, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So he watched for an opportunity to hand him over.
My prayer is that after we've looked at God's word this evening, we might be able to echo the words of verse 4. "With the whole realm of nature mine, that were an offering far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. All because the cross is just so wondrous." When Mark wrote his gospel account of the life of Jesus, he clearly paid no attention to avoiding spoilers. A spoiler is when you give away some crucial information about a story. It could be the end of the story or just something important that happens in the story. Mark is very good at giving them away. Nobody likes spoilers though. I had a comic shop that I used to visit in Aylesbury, and behind the counter was a huge sign that read, "No spoilers." Most of the guys in the shop were mostly normal, but that could change in a second if you gave away a spoiler. It is a bit scarring watching a grown man go, "Oh, no, 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 no." I can still see the images. I know someone at our last church who would record the Formula One Grand Prix and then come back later and watch the race at a more reasonable hour after church. He was so anxious about spoilers that the first thing he would say to you when he came through the door, before even greeting you, was, "I haven't seen the race yet. Don't say a word. I don't want to know anything." Spoilers are becoming a big thing on the internet, and movie directors are going to extreme lengths to prevent info about their movies getting out. There's evidently a running joke among the cast and crew of the new Marvel movies that the young and likable Tom Holland, who acts as Spider-Man, can't keep a secret to save his life. Joe Russo, one of the directors of Avengers Infinity War, recently told BBC Radio Scotland that his way around Tom Holland giving away spoilers was to give him a fake script. During the interview, the director said, "Tom's had a couple of slip-ups in the past. He's now on the blacklist. We wrote fake scripts to the whole cast, but we wrote a really fake script for Tom Holland." Tom Holland, even though he acted as one of the main characters, still doesn't know what the movie's main plot is. And the first time he'll actually know what the movie is about is when he sees it with us after its release. For Mark, the gospel writer, though, the idea of spoilers are a foreign concept. His gospel about the life of Jesus is filled with what we might call spoilers. Right from his first line, chapter 1, verse 1, he tells us the beginning of the good news about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And in the first 8 chapters, Mark explains that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. But he'd given that away in his first sentence. In chapter 3, Mark gives away another clanger. He gives away another plot line as he names the 12 apostles. Take a look at Mark chapter 3, verse 13. Mark chapter 3, verse 13. It says the following: Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12, designating them apostles, that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. These are the 12 he appointed: Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, to them he gave the names Sons of Thunder, Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. So we know from early on that Jesus is going to be betrayed by Judas. And 3 times in chapters 8 to 10, Jesus teaches about what it means to follow him and that he will die at the hands of his enemies. Chapter 8, verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Mark has given it away. We know that Jesus will die at the hands of his enemies. We also know that he won't stay dead, but that he'll rise 3 days later. Mark even tells us beforehand who it is that's conspiring against Jesus. Right from chapter 3, verse 6, Mark doesn't mince his words. He just says plainly, the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. And before we even get to the cross, we're told why Jesus must die. Mark 10:45. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus' death would pay the ransom for many. And so we have 5 spoilers as we come into this evening's passage. The first is that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. We also know that Jesus will be betrayed by Judas. We know that Jesus will die. Before it happens, we know that Jesus will be killed by the Jewish and Roman authorities. And we know that Jesus' death is a ransom for many. But Mark is not an inept story writer. Instead, he's a divinely inspired gospel writer. And he threads these so-called spoilers for a divinely inspired reason. He wants to draw our attention to them and teach us through them. He wants us to anticipate how it's going to turn out. He wants to make a point. And now in the final chapters of Mark, these recorded spoilers, if you want to call them that, will find their fulfillment and meaning. And by this point, everyone should know how the story is going to end. But Mark shows us that they don't get it. To a certain degree, it's like the last page of the novel has been read, but they still don't get how the book actually ends. And the surprise is that everyone is still surprised as Jesus goes to the cross, when really there shouldn't have been any surprises at all. We know already who Jesus is. Mark's already told us what it means to follow him. And in chapters 14 to 16, we're going to see just how Jesus will bring about his reign over God's kingdom. And our passage this evening is going to address and take a look at some of these spoilers. The first thing I want us to think about this evening is that we should expect schemers, but also for things to work out God's way. Following verse 1. Now the Passover and the festival of unleavened bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were looking for some sly way to arrest Jesus and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or the people may riot. And then skip down to verse 10. Notice how easily the story continues. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So he watched for an opportunity to hand him over. These few verses that we've just read form what's known as a Markan sandwich, and we've seen it used before in Mark's gospel. Most recently, we saw it in the passage about the fig tree and the temple. And Jesus uses this technique to group stories, to draw contrast, and to highlight a point. And so, yeah, he deals with the scheming chief priests and the teachers of the law and their plan to arrest and kill Jesus. And then he places a new story in between before picking up the story again of the scheming authorities. And like we did now when we read it, we could leave out verses 3 to 9 without it damaging the flow of the story at all. But the story in between, it's not there to make sequential sense, but rather to teach us a theological truth. And we'll come to that in a moment. But for now, we have plan, the scheming, and plan made, with Judas coming to betray Jesus, as the outside of the sandwich, the bread, if you like, with the story of the unknown woman anointing Jesus in between as the filler. Verses 1 and 2 and then 10 and 11 fit together neatly. Verses 1 and 2 describe just how sinister and scheming the Jewish authorities actually are. They're getting together and they're thinking up a plot to end Jesus. We've already seen in Mark chapter 3, 11 and 12, that they're out to get Jesus. After Jesus clears the temple, we have these words. The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. And then Jesus teaches the parable of the tenants against them, and they had this to say. Well, this is what Mark reflects on that event. He says, then they looked for a way to arrest him because they knew he had spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away. These guys are cunning and smart. Their goal is to have Jesus killed, but they're also cautious to not cause civil unrest. Not only because Jesus was popular with the crowd, but at the time of Passover, Jerusalem is jam-packed, heaving with visitors. We guess somewhere between 4 or 5 times as many people. Celebrating the Passover in Jewish culture had become pretty much an Independence Day celebration, as they remember how God rescued them from slavery in Egypt. A nationalistic fervor was high, and the whole city was on guard, while the crowd celebrated, the Roman and Jewish authorities were on high alert. And nobody wanted a repeat of previous bloody riots or revolts. We're told in Mark chapter 15 that this sensitivity at Jesus' trial is what finally persuaded Pilate to crucify Jesus. Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Pilate was more concerned that the crowd was satisfied, because he knew what they were capable of, than the life of an innocent man. So they want Jesus to die, but they don't want him to die at the Passover. That was their plan. But it was God's plan that Jesus would die at the Passover to show that he is the true Passover. Jesus would die during the Passover, not according to the plans of man, but according to the plans of God. And in verse 10, Judas goes to the chief priests and betrays Jesus. He agrees to hand Jesus over to them, to give them an opportunity to arrest Jesus. Mark doesn't give us his motive. Mark doesn't even tell us the amount of money he was paid. That's not the point that Mark's trying to make. The point is that the plan of those scheming against Jesus is coming together. The end is drawing near. We've come around the last bend and we're on the final straight for Jesus, for the gospel, and for his plan to become king. See, will the chief priests and teachers of the law get their way? Will their plan succeed? Well, the spoiler's out, isn't it? Jesus has already told us numerous times that in a limited sense, they do win. Jesus does die. But in the end, he is raised to life because death cannot hold him. And he has the final, ultimate victory as God's plan is finally fulfilled. God's plan, not the plans of man, will prevail. Judas, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law stand as examples of those up against Jesus. Those that won't accept him, those that don't accept him. But they should have known better. Judas spent 3 years with Jesus, but it didn't mean a thing. The chief priests and teachers of the law knew the Old Testament scriptures better than most, but they clearly didn't understand them. Those that should have known better are the schemers and the betrayer. And I think there's a warning there for us. You know, we know stuff about Jesus, and we know stuff about the Bible. We can even do stuff for Jesus. We can be involved in ministry. We can read the Bible. We can go to church. We can even have a good understanding of biblical doctrine. We can do, and we can know. But it means nothing if our heart is far from Jesus. And our hearts are vulnerable. Judas lived with Jesus, shared a table with him, shared a campfire with him, saw the miracles and heard his teaching, and he ended up betraying him. We know that the chief priests and teachers of the law were basically out to get Jesus because he was a threat to them and made them look foolish. But Mark doesn't tell us what Jesus' motive is for rejecting Jesus. And I wonder if we sit here and stand here this evening, if we know what the greatest threat to our relationship with Jesus is. You know, what could cause us to reject Jesus? What can the devil use against us? What is going to test our faith the most? See, I bet Judas never thought that one day he would reject Jesus and betray him. See, Jesus has just warned in the previous chapter that there are going to be those that are going to fall away. Jesus says it's going to happen. He wants us to know it's going to happen. You see, we can't let it be us. Don't let it be you and me. We don't want to be like these examples. We want to be more like the unnamed woman splitting the story of the schemers. We're meant to see the stark contrast between her and those around her. The first thing we noted is that we should expect schemers, but also for things to work out exactly how God intends them to. I want us also to think about this evening, is that devotion to Jesus means doing what you can for Jesus. Devotion to Jesus means doing what you can for Jesus. I guess most of us know who Susan Boyle is. She's been used in many sermons and many, many illustrations. But the story of Susan Boyle's rise to fame is very well known, isn't it? Looking unimpressive, ridiculed and discarded, she belted out "I Dreamed a Dream" at Britain's Got Talent in 2009. You see, nobody would ever underestimate her ever again. She turned Britain's Got Talent from a question to a statement. And she has since released 7 music albums. She's broken 6 Guinness World Records and won numerous awards, including World's Best-Selling British Artist in 2010. But judging from her first appearance, nobody would have guessed. Nobody would have suspected that nearly a decade later that we would still remember her and be buying her music. She has made her mark on the British music industry and the world. And our unnamed woman in verses 3 to 9 has made an impact that far outshadows and outreaches that of Susan Boyle. Because 2,000 years after she did what she did, we still remember her and hold her up as an example of devotion to Jesus, just as Jesus said she would. Take a look at verse 9. I tell you the truth, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. And verse 3 tells us what she did. While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of a man known as Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. And verse 4 to 8 tells us how those present responded and how Jesus responded to their response. Take a look at verse 4. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, "Why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor." And they rebuked her harshly. "Leave her alone," said Jesus. "Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them any time you want, but you will not always have me." She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. And so there's 3 things that are going on here. In verse 3, we have the woman's costly action of breaking the flask of perfume and pouring it over Jesus' head. And we're not sure whether the woman fully understood the implications of her actions, which Jesus describes in verse 8 as her preparing him for his burial. But it's clearly an act of loving devotion to Jesus. And Jesus describes it as a beautiful thing in verse 7. And Mark contrasts her lavish act of devotion with the rejection of the Jewish leaders and of Judas. He's planting a seed and he's leading us to ask, how does my devotion measure up? Who am I like? The devoted woman? The scheming Jewish leaders? Or the betrayer? And this act of love from this woman is Mark 12:29 in action. She is loving the Lord her God with all her heart, soul, mind, and strength. And we don't know how much she gets of what's going on, but she gets enough to drive her to devotion. It could be a small mustard seed faith, but it's enough for her to act in devotion. She can do this beautiful thing for Jesus because she sees something of the beauty of Jesus. And she stands with the widow who gives all her money at the temple in Mark 12 and demonstrates to us full devotion to Jesus. The widow in chapter 12 gives and was left with nothing. And here the woman gives a very, very expensive gift. We need to see that nothing is too much to give to God's kingdom. The second thing that's going on here is the indignant response of some of those present. And we see that in verses 4 and 5. And we're not told who these people are, but I think it's fair to assume that the disciples were among them. And again, they demonstrate a failure to understand all that Jesus is about to do on their behalf and what their proper response should be. And we also have an estimate of the value of the woman's gift, a year's worth of wages. Here's a heart experiment to try quickly. Think of your annual salary amount. Think of that amount before taxes and before deductions. Now imagine the cost of giving that amount to the extension of Jesus' kingdom. You see, that gives us an idea of the cost of the woman's devotion to Jesus. Remember, she's standing as an example to us. I think it's easier to give money, even a vast sum of money, than to the cause of the gospel. Sorry, it's easier to give money, even a vast sum of money, to the cause of the gospel than living every day in devotion to Jesus. The cost of the perfume was high, but think of the high social cost she paid as she gives this gift to Jesus. As a woman, she was looked down upon, frowned upon, and with very little rights in first century Jewish culture. But yet she comes into a room full of men, and they rebuke her, exposed and vulnerable. But she does it anyway. I think we all know that kind of isolation, of walking into a room and we're different to everyone else. I remember seeing a picture somewhere of a bunch of football fans, I think it was, and they told one of their mates that they were all going to dress up. And the mate came and he was the only one dressed up. We all know what that feels like, don't we? We may not feel fear, but we know the intimidation, that feeling out. And she probably felt it, but it didn't stop her from doing this beautiful thing for Jesus. You see, devotion to Jesus comes from seeing the beauty of Jesus. This woman saw something of that beauty. When we look at the cross, we see all and the full beauty of Jesus. It's coming. The third thing we notice in these little verses is that we see Jesus' interpretation of the woman's action. And we see that in verses 6 to 9. See, they rebuke her, and then Jesus stands up for her and rebukes them. He doesn't rebuke them for wanting to care for the poor. In fact, he tells them that there'll be plenty of opportunity to carry on doing this. And it's our basic responsibility as his followers. We can all make reasonable excuses for not helping the poor. Excuses like, it won't help them in the long run. And I don't think any of our excuses will stand before God. God has a heart for the poor. God has a heart for those facing injustice. Instead, we're so worried about helping in the right way that we end up doing nothing. And surely doing nothing is worse than doing something the wrong way. Rather, Jesus rebukes them for getting their timing wrong. He is about to leave them, as he's persistently told them, and they still do not see the need to honor him. Their priority at this time should be to revere him, but they fail to see it. In contrast, the woman has acted with total devotion to Jesus. She has acted prophetically as she anoints his body for burial. Jesus also makes an extraordinary prediction here that his death will be gospel, that his death will be good news preached in all the world. Because Jesus' death is good news. It's great news. His opponents thought they could stop him by killing him, but they were actually just part of God's amazing plan. They wanted him dead after the Passover, but he died at the Passover to show that he is the ultimate Passover. And judgment will pass over us because it didn't pass over Jesus at the cross. Mark's gospel is full of spoilers. Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. We've seen it proved already in his words and actions in Mark chapter 1 to 8. And we'll see it confirmed beyond any doubt through his death and his resurrection. We're also told that Jesus will be betrayed by Judas. And in our passage this evening, we've seen just how that is developing as Judas makes plans to do the deed. Jesus will die. Again, Jesus says he's going to die in this passage. And we've seen the plan develop of the Jewish leaders and authorities as they plan to kill Jesus. And we're given clues that Jesus will be the true Passover, to be a ransom for many. Tonight we see that Jesus knows exactly what's going on around him, but he's not perturbed, because it's all going according to his Father's plan, not to man's. You see, and I think we've got to ask ourselves, how are we going to respond to Jesus? Are we going to respond with devotion like the unnamed woman? Or rejection like Judas and the schemers? Devotion to Jesus means doing whatever you can for Jesus. Loving the Lord, our God, with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, and with all our strength.